Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Thomas Roberts, who is a professor emeritus at the Northern Illinois University and a former visiting scientist at Johns Hopkins. I, of course, went to Johns Hopkins many, many years ago. The book we are interviewing him on is a compilation work of many of the, people who were involved in certain experiments, as well as other people who are experts in this area. The book is entitled Spiritual Growth with, and I guess I'm going to need help on the pronunciation of this, Etherogens, Psychoactive Sacramentals and Human Transformation. So this book has contributors such as Houston Smith, Stan Groff, Albert Hoffman, and others that our listeners are probably familiar with. Welcome, Dr. Roberts. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
So, would you like to tell a little bit of your story on how you became involved with, the exploration of spiritual growth with the psychoactive compounds mentioned in the book?
Yes. The word entheogen was proposed as a substitute for the word psychedelic. And some people mm-hmm. use one word and some people use the other. What I prefer to do is to use psychedelic for the psychological, psychotherapeutic use, and entheogen for the spiritual aspect of it.
Okay.
And so that's where that word comes from. It means generating the experience of God within. And Theo is the God, generates.
Okay, great.
So you want some history of the book, maybe?
I'm sorry?
Would you like to know how the book developed?
Yes, that would be great. And
okay.
How you became interested in the subject.
Oh, okay. Well, let's start with the interest. I was historically first.
Both would be good.
I was taking a course at Stanford in graduate school called the Human Potential, which mm-hmm. oddly enough was in an engineering department. And a part of what we were discussing was the use of psychedelics, which at that time had just become illegal, but people were still talking about them. And I heard a graduate student couple talk about them and the experience they had the previous Saturday. They didn't seem to be crazy or fit my sort of stereotype of the wild drug user, so that was a little strange. And then later I got a free ticket to a lecture by a theologian and philosopher, Alan Watts, and he was talking about the spiritual use of psychedelics. And I'd never heard this at all. So mm-hmm. I started reading about it and having my own experiences. And quite much to my surprise, I at one time, a year or two later, I had what I think was a pretty full-blown mystical experience. And then I realized at that time that religion and spiritual development really was about something, that is an experience someone can have, not just an accumulation of ideas that have sort of accreted through thousands of years. So that at that point is when I started to take religion seriously. And since then, I've been writing on it. Excuse me, and then that we had a conference that was the origin of that book. And so sort of just one thing leads to another, and that's the path that I followed.
Well, thank you. I had actually taken a course with Timothy Leary before he passed away. And I guess that a discussion of this subject might start with some of the ideas Timothy Leary had. Would you like to just talk a little bit about his ideas and what the experiments at Harvard, started?
Okay, actually, I'm not much of a follower of Timothy Leary.
Uh-huh.
Although when he was there, he did some work with prisoners and
mm-hmm.
Actually gave them mescaline or psychedelics, and he took it along with them so that they would know he was not just sort of using them as guinea pigs.
Right.
And they found afterwards that there was a lower recidivism rate, although they also gave the prisoners some additional help after they had graduated, or rather, mm-hmm. been released from jail. So I'm not sure exactly. Nobody knows exactly what was from the help and what was from the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he got interested in, to me, it was more sort of showmanship than, you know, science or theology. And I'm not really interested in that angle of it. So all I've read by him is his autobiography, which is a fascinating book. I suggest it to my students if they're looking for a self-directed book to sort of catch up on those times. So that's about all I have to say.
Yeah, he was the most well-known.
Although I met him once when he spoke here quite a few years ago.
I just mentioned him because he's the one that our listeners probably know about, bringing forth the idea that LSD, anyway, could be used for medicinal purposes.
Really considered what's an older generation now. And new people really have quite a different take on it from what he had.
Right. So many of the people in your book were participants or at least refer to the experiment that was done in 1962. Would you like to tell the listeners about that?
Oh, the Good Friday Experiment.
Right, the Good Friday Experiment.
Yes, all right. There was a man named Walter Pankey who already was a medical doctor, and I think he had another degree, a PhD degree, and he wondered whether, under the right conditions, if people who were in seminaries would have a religious mystical experience. It's important to recognize at this point that in the psychology of religion and theology, the word mysticism is used in a very particular sense. It's not about, you know, weird things and zombies and Area 51 and all that kind of stuff. It's about a particular clump of religious experiences. And so he arranged on a Good Friday afternoon in 1962 to have 20 students from Andover Newton Theological Seminary in the basement of Marsh Chapel at Boston University, half received psilocybin and half received an active placebo. And he wondered whether, given that situation, and the upstairs, the sermon was sort of broadcast downstairs over loudspeakers, whether they would have mystical experiences. And that's known as the Good Friday Experiment or the Miracle at Marsh Chapel.
Mm-hmm.
Of the 10 that received the psilocybin, 9 reported that they had mystical experience. And there's a standard sort of checklist to use to determine whether something's mystical experience. And one who said he didn't actually change his mind when he thought about it later and did. And he has the first chapter in that book that we're talking about.
Right.
And so this led to a lot of interest in the religious use of psychedelics. But right about this time was when they were getting a really bad reputation because of people using them sort of on the street and informally and in dangerous situations. So that research was sort of frozen in the mid-1960s and didn't pick up again until, probably about 10 years ago. So that's sort of where we are on that. And a particularly interesting thing about that is that Rick Doblin, who is the president founder of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, wondered, now, what happened to these people over the years? So he did a follow-up study of them basically 25 years later and found that those who had the psilocybin mystical experience were more likely to stay in the profession of being a clergyman and look back on it as a very important aspect of their own spiritual and professional development, whereas those who had the placebo, although it was an active placebo, didn't put much importance on it at all. The numbers are too small to come up with a good statistical thing. So really what needs to be done is that needs to be replicated with current research and current statistics, because research methods have improved enormously, you know, since the 1960s. And the work that they did at Johns Hopkins is a sort of replication and updating of that study.
So an important theme throughout the book is that the experience itself is not a guarantee for any lasting changes in one's spiritual life, and that it actually probably does matter at what point you are in your spiritual development when you take the drug. Is that correct?
Yes, apparently so. Because some people will, you know, have sort of what seems to be a blowout mystical experience on Saturday and then think, well, that was weird on Sunday, and go back to being their ordinary selves. And others will find their worlds basically reorganized. And there's an experience that alters everything else. And the question is, of course, who has that effect and why and under what situations and so forth. So that's an area that really has to be looked at.
And one of the authors pointed out that his first experience, which I think was in that Good Friday experiment, showed him that he really was a control freak, that it was necessary for him to take a look at that in order to even have experiences with lower doses of psychoactive drugs. So things like being a control freak can, or wanting to control that experience in particular versus wanting to open up to the experience and let anything in that needs to come in, and not be actively using your psyche to oppose it. These are very important things. I mean,
yeah, that's exactly right. And that's the key element of whether people have a mystical experience or just sort of an odd sensory type experience.
They fight with things,
That's right.
Or they have openings into the psyche that are unpleasant.
Right.
I mean, things come up out of the psyche that are very frightening, scary, and unpleasant. And, I mean, the bad trip LSD thing or there's a real good chapter in here on whether or not they really do add strychnine and these other poisons to LSD, or are these just opening into that aspect of the psyche?
Basically, the bad experiences. Now, assuming somebody has a pure dose, okay, the bad experiences almost are always memories or fantasies of trauma that are coming up to the consciousness, which is good in a psychotherapeutic situation, but you wouldn't want to do that in a spiritual situation. So,
right.
For example,
these people were screened for psychological conditions that might be contraindications for this in a spiritual experience, right?
No, they weren't in the Good Friday experiment. They weren't screened.
They weren't?
They didn't know at that time that screening was important. That
you needed that, yeah, okay.
Yeah. No, these were graduate students in a theological seminary, so they tended to be sort of more grounded than the ordinary walking around person.
Right. They got into a college-type situation,
Yeah, so this was in the graduate school, so, yeah.
Right. And they were I'm saying their orientation was toward being open to a spiritual experience too. I mean, I think
yes,
a lot of people
exactly
that take drugs do it for other reasons, not necessarily to experience a spiritual. They don't even really understand that there is a realm of spirituality out there and that they can experience. They take the drug for other reasons,
And of course, that sample is not at all representative of people in general. I mean, you have seminarians at a Good Friday service in a church, so their expectations and their setting would make them sort of go in that direction. It wouldn't necessarily apply to other people, sort of ordinary people walking around.
So some of the other authors in the book talk about the importance of having, especially in Native American traditions and other religious or spiritual groups, the ability to have these psychoactive, not particularly LSD or psilocybin, but their native plants available, like peyote and I can't pronounce the one. Is it
ayahuasca?
Ayahuasca, yeah.
Ayahuasca,
available
from the Amazon.
Oh, does it? Yeah, available for their religious ceremonies. And that's a very important point. And would you like to tell the listening audience about the how that went to the Supreme Court and what the results were?
Yeah, there have been two cases that have gone up. The main one, there was a branch, or should call it a mission, of a Brazilian church in either New Mexico or Arizona, I'm not sure which. And the sacrament is ayahuasca, which is made from two plants in the Amazon. And they and a tea, a sort of thick tea is made out of it. And they had a drum of it shipped back, which was, of course, intercepted at customs. And because it has the drug DMT in it, which is a Schedule I drug, customs held it and wouldn't release it to them because DMT is a restricted psychoactive drug.
Yeah.
So the church sued customs to release the ayahuasca so that they could use it in their in, as a sacrament. And it was a federal case. So three local judges heard it, and two determined in favor of the church. So the Drug Enforcement Administration then appealed it to a district court, which is a local bench, which is all the judges in a particular district, and they also determined in favor of the church. So the DEA appealed it to the Supreme Court.
Supreme Court.
Yeah, right. And they had a hearing on it. And they heard the hearing was, I think, in November of the year, and then February or March or so, they actually had a vote and released their vote. Now, in the meantime, one of the judges had retired, and Chief Judge John Roberts was appointed, so he hadn't heard the case, so he couldn't vote on it. So there are only eight judges that can vote on it, and they voted 8-0. To return it to the local district court. When the Supreme Court tells you to reconsider something, that's a pretty strong message. And so they have, I think they have now released it to the church. I've actually lost track of that case. There was another one in Oregon of two Native Americans who had attended the peyote ceremony, like the ones you just mentioned. And they were working for a government, I think it was a state agency, and they were not allowed, as part of their employment, to do illegal drugs. Their boss asked them if they had attended the ceremony, and they said, if they'd done any illegal drugs, and they said, no, but we went to a peyote ceremony last week as part of our religion. They were members of the Native American Church, and they got fired. So then they applied for unemployment compensation. And because they had been fired for drug use, unemployment compensation was denied. So this then went up to the Supreme Court, and the court decided in favor of the appellants, and so they were able to get their unemployment compensation.
Okay.
So these
yeah,
cases
but that
are coming along.
Right.
A real problem with this, though, is that these apparently are legitimate churches that have some background to them. But what if, you know, a bunch of people get together and say, hey, let's do drugs, we'll call ourselves a church. And
well,
so
that's true.
that could be misused, and the courts hate to address religious issues because it puts them in the position of saying what is or is not religion, and they just don't like to do that.
Yeah. So people who are doing these ceremonies, even under a legitimate Native American church, are still taking a risk then?
No, Native American Church is, if they are Native Americans and are a member of the Native American Church, there's no problem there. Two laws were passed, one Restoration of Religious Freedom Act, and another one which particularly was looked at the Native American Church and particularly gave them permission to use peyote. So that's a legitimate use now.
Now, the ayahuasca ceremonies that go on, is that still considered illegal then?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Because it contains DMT.
There are sort of underground churches. This is remarkably like, you know, when Christianity was being spread around, because it was ill at, let's say, when the Bible was first printed, it was actually illegal to hold a Bible. And people had to have ceremonies, you know, hidden and in quiet, and it was all an underground kind of thing. Only now, instead of a book or print, it's now, you know, the drug itself is used as a sacrament.
Right.
Very, very similar kind of sort of persecution and appeal mm-hmm. going on right now.
Well, there's such a bias in this country, particularly against drug use and such, you know, legal battles about it. You know, from marijuana to DMT. I've interviewed people on the book on DMT, so it's a very interesting ethical dilemma that people who want to have spiritual experiences, especially in the U.S., I think a lot of them actually leave the country to not be crossways with the law.
Yes, there's quite a bit of what's called ayahuasca tourism to the Amazon.
Mm-hmm. And right.
Some of the people providing the experience are sort of legitimate shaman, and some are just people who feel, you know, they can get some money from the North Americans, so just, you know,
mm-hmm.
provide some. And so there are both some very good and some very bad experiences that come out of that. I don't know of any sort of way of judging, you know, when you hear an ad, is this a legitimate guy or just somebody who's after your money?
Yeah, probably you would have to talk to other people who have gone through the experience, too.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, right.
Just like anything, yeah. Well, one of the chapters here by Houston Smith is called "Do Drugs Have Religious Import?" And I guess, you know, most of the book is addressing that question. You know, are the religious and spiritual experiences that some people have on the psychoactive drugs, and there's different drugs too. I guess you can't lump them all together. Is that something that is useful in the person seeking experiential things to further their spiritual life?
Yeah, for some people it clearly is, and for some people it clearly isn't. And the
mm-hmm.
question of who and under what situations sort of is one of the vague areas. Actually, Houston Smith was largely indirectly responsible for that book. When Bob, Jesse, and I were planning the conference that this was derived from, there have been a fair number of conferences where people got together and talked about, you know, the religious use of psychedelics, their entheogenic mm-hmm. use. And I got the Chicago Theological Seminary to agree to jointly sponsor a conference. So this gives it a certain panache and acceptability that it was a very well-respected theological school. And I asked Houston if he would be one of the speakers. And when he said yes, he is so well-known and so worldwide respected, almost everybody else fell right in line. That if Houston is coming, you're going to speak on it, then
mm-hmm.
I'm going to come. And so this book is an outgrowth from that conference. It's not a record of what happened at the conference. What we did is we asked the people there if they would write a chapter for the book, taking into account the discussions and the lectures and things they had heard at the conference. So this is not just a collection of talks people gave at the conference. Some, like Houston's,
right.
are pretty similar, and some are entirely new. Houston also has written probably the best known book in the field, he had written 8 or 10 different articles on psychedelics over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And at the conference, he mentioned he was going to be interviewed by Bill Moyers next spring. A series on faith paths, and I knew that once he had got on, it was a special PBS special 5-part series that he was going to be very hard to attract as a speaker. So I asked him right
mm-hmm.
on the spot if he could come to Northern and speak,
mm-hmm.
and so he did, and that was the fall of 1966, and in preparation to take my students there, I collected all of his papers together and had them read his background to his talk. And then it occurred to me that would make a book. So I talked with Bob
right.
Jesse at the Council on Spiritual Practices and in Houston, and Houston sort of rewrote them and polished them, and then we have his book.
Now, that book you just referred to, is that the religious significance of, is that the title of the book, the religious significance of entheogenic plants and chemicals beyond the postmodern mind?
Yes, that's it.
Okay, but that's the book. Yeah, because he's got a lot of different books here.
Yeah.
So that was that the first book that really looked at this?
Well, there's some, you know, there's some Timothy Leary books, and there were several books sort of on peyote and on ayahuasca. But Houston's was the first real accepted philosopher to write on the question.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a sort of an updating, polishing of his previous works. So that's how that book came about. And
yeah.
He is so well respected that that brought everybody else in.
Right. Yeah, Dr. Stan Groff is also a very well known contributor.
Yes, he certainly is. He's probably the world's best known clinical researcher on psychedelics, and he uses them in a psychotherapeutic, perspective rather than a spiritual perspective. But of course, a lot of his patients had spiritual experiences.
Right, that's true. Yeah, he's written lots of books on, the Kundalini rising, spiritual emergency, when that happens too quickly.
I'm a great fan of his.
Yeah,
he's one of the great minds of our times.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we're probably in a time period now where we really need to address that aspect of this work, in that the energies that seem to be coming in are stirring things up in a way that that are bringing things to the surface, and so the Kundalini experiences, and by the way, the Kundalini experiences are often not differentiated from the psychotic breaks or even neurological illnesses. For example, I had a friend who had a very sudden Kundalini rising and was getting severe jerks and involuntary movements, and actually went to a friend of mine who was a neurologist, who ordered about $10,000 worth of neurological exams, which were negative. And we just spent probably, I would say, 10 minutes with him with a group of healers to balance the energy, and then he got relief from that particular symptom. So, in order not to really increase our cost of healthcare in this country at this particular time, I think we need to tell people that a lot of these spontaneous neurological symptoms, and some are numbness, some are involuntary motions, some are, anxiety, some are, sudden symptoms, either neurological or psychological, can be due to what Dr. Groff has been talking about for the last, over 25 years for sure. And people doctors need to study that.
Yes, that certainly is true.
The answer is not, $10,000 worth of tests that are going to be negative. It's not going to help the patient. It's going to drive the cost of healthcare up.
Yes,
so
it sure does.
I don't see this being addressed in the neurological or psychiatric community. I don't think people understand what's really going on. They just label it all as neurological or psychological and don't differentiate it.
Yes, that's unfortunately really true. Yeah, yes, the neurologists and the mental health professionals really have to learn about this field.
They really do. And it was interesting because when I addressed this with my friend, he's a very much Roman Catholic, I tried to tell him about Kundalini, and all he could do, and this man is very much a very enlightened Roman Catholic. I mean, very enlightened. All he could focus on is the fact that the snake was evil. Kundalini was snake and snake was evil. He couldn't hear me. He couldn't hear when I said, wait a minute, this is, these are energies trying to incorporate into, the human energy system and there's blockages there, and the blockages are then causing neurological and psychiatric symptoms. You know, that's what's going on. And so what do you do? Well, you remove the blockage. You help the patient remove the blockage through energetic methods, and then their symptoms go away. I mean, it's actually, you got to make the right diagnosis in order to know what the treatment is. So,
Of course, the caduceus does have a snake going up it.
Well, it does, but, you know, the snake in Christianity is like the, you know, what happened in the Garden of Eden, you know.
Yeah.
It's just not,
There's another place in the Bible, I don't know where it is, that somebody makes snakes rise and people are healed. And it's
really?
Well,
that's interesting.
Yeah. One of my students told me about it years ago and quoted it, and I don't remember where it is. I think it must be in the Old Testament somewhere.
Yeah. Well, for our listening audience, what Dr. Groff's work, and there's other people too, I mean, I've actually lectured twice at the Kundalini Research Council, so, you know, I'm real familiar with this topic. But essentially, when you start to do certain religious practices, and Kundalini Yoga being the one that people always mention, because if it's done without proper, you know, mentors, you can get a lot of symptoms. In any case, you do certain spiritual practices, which awakens an energy that starts, and it's the energy is described by two snakes going, twirling each other up your spine, and that's where the caduceus comes from, the double snakes that are used for the symbol of medicine. And this really is a clue into spiritual medicine, because really, for permanent fixes of most chronic diseases, other than those that are toxic, you need to have spiritual experiences in order to raise your kundalini, in order to get over the blockages that are causing the illness. You see?
Yes, that's right.
I mean, you really do. So, but what I'm saying is I believe, because I feel it in my own body, other people who are involved in, you know, spirituality and intense meditation feel it in their bodies. There's energies coming in right now. They started in July, and they're going to increase until, you know, perhaps the end of the year, or maybe even beyond, we really don't know, that are spinning this energy, this kundalini energy, up. And what it's doing to people who are not prepared is it's making them very volatile and very prone to neurological and psychiatric symptoms. And so you see people kind of freaking out. You see people freaking out on airplanes, people, you know, the worst examples are the mass shootings and the, you know, just a lot of different acting out in public, way more than we saw earlier. So that's what why things going on.
A question I have about this. I have a book coming out in January, and there's one of the chapters is titled, do psychedelic-induced mystical experiences boost the immune system? And
that's
some of those
instances
may be getting the kundalini active.
Yeah, because especially at the heart, the immune system is the thymus in part, and then, of course, it's the bone marrow for the other part of the immune system. But the immune system that we're talking about that's depressed now is T-cell immunity. And it's depressed because of the massive amount of chemical toxicity we have in our environment. So if you can raise energy up to the heart, which is opening of the heart chakra and putting more energy into that center, theoretically, you should have better immunity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know what scientific experiment you would do that, but the psychedelics might allow the kundalini energy to go up. And so have you heard in your research of people having a experience induced by psychedelics that caused an opening of their heart, the compassion, the, you know, that kind of experience?
Yes, in fact, that is a standard effect of a mystical experience, is to become less involved in one's own ego, more interested in helping the world and friends and society. There's actually one of the parts of the research they did at Johns Hopkins, they had something called an altruism scale. And people had the mystical experiences went way up on the altruism scale. And they checked it, you know, it wasn't just right after the event, but, you know, several days later, and then again several months later, and then 14 months later. So people became less involved with, you know, what's going to happen to me, and more in what's good for society, what's good for humanity in general. Yeah,
and that comes out of the oneness. You know, one of the things on that scale, too, is the degree of oneness, you know, the feeling that all is one, which
yes.
is a, which not, probably not every time, but often people experience. And that's, and I want to really tell the listeners, and your authors also talk about this. This is not the idea of oneness. This is not an intellectual concept. This is, this is a feeling, a knowing, a, it's hard to describe, and that's what you say in the book. These feelings are hard to describe. The idea of that everything really is one, and not just all humans are one, but everything is one. You know,
yes,
beyond that.
Whole, it can go all the way up to the whole cosmos.
Right.
Have you had Ralph Hood as on your show? He's the guy who developed
the mystical. I don't think so.
He'd be really good. He developed the mystical experience scale, and he's at the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga.
Okay. Well, that
and he's really the man in this
down.
Field. Yeah,
okay,
Ralph
thank
Hood
you.
Jr.
Okay. Yeah. So these, I think that for me anyway, the most important thing to take out of this book is that the ideas that we're talking about are ideas. They're located in the mental realm. But and you can learn all your life about ideas. But none of this really becomes incorporated into your life in a lasting way until you have an experience.
That's right.
It's the
difference between reading a menu and actually eating the food.
Exactly. You can talk all day about what something tastes like, but actually tasting it is a whole other thing. So
yes,
this is a very important concept. And so some people, despite years of all sorts of spiritual practices, do not actually have an experience. And so the idea behind the book is for these people, these seekers, these people who are really the core of their life is their spiritual life. You know, what is the harm in them under controlled circumstances with shamans or other people experienced in leading people through this? You know, what is the harm of this? And you know, I think most of us have to admit that there's no harm in it other than the fact that you probably have to leave the United States to do it.
Well, I think we're entering a new era in religion.
Uh-huh.
The one we're in now is basically based on words, beliefs, text. It's a
mm-hmm.
cognitive word-oriented era,
mm-hmm.
and I think we're entering an era of experiential religion. And the psychedelics and ayahuasca and things like yoga and you mentioned
mm-hmm.
Kundalini, I think are moving us into a whole new way of looking at religion, not as a collection of ideas, but as kinds of experience.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Just like 500 years ago, in Western Europe, religion went from being predominantly going to church
mm-hmm.
and participating that way. When the printed word came out, thanks to Gutenberg and others, religion then became very cognitively, verbally oriented. That's the
mm-hmm.
where we've been for the last 500 years, and I think now we're adding to that experiences in addition to the text. So, for example, if we ask somebody what their religion is, we expect them to say what their beliefs are. We don't expect them to say what experiences have they had. But I think we're moving to an experiential period now. So this is a big transition.
Yeah, and I think this energy that I talked about, that I've actually interviewed other authors on, this energy coming in from the Galactic Center, that is, you can feel in your body, and you can see the effects of. I think this energy is inducing experiences, too. I think it will induce a lot more experiences, and that's probably how the shift will occur. Not because, you know, that you actually seek out something to induce it, but I think that in general we're being bathed in the energy that will induce it. So it'll be interesting to see in the next 6 months what happens to spontaneous spiritual and mystical experiences.
Well, I think it's going to be a decade-long transition.
Oh, it
could
be, definitely.
And it includes things like contemplative prayer and breathing mm-hmm. exercises and the martial arts. And these are all more than just exercises. They're spiritual things, as you know. And,
right.
and I think the interest in all these fields is developing sort of throughout our society and moving us all in that direction.
Well, I've been doing this radio show for 17 years, and the thing that struck me just recently is how many more books now are out regarding these topics than, say, were even 10 years ago or 20 years ago. It's just incredible.
Yeah, certainly I know about the intellectual sort of theme of that, and that's certainly true in that, psychedelic area. That's certainly true there, and I assume all the others are too. Well, all those books coming out of inner traditions in Vermont cover lots of these
mm-hmm.
things.
Yeah, they're just exploding. I mean, they used to be really thin. You know, you used to get little thin flyers from them, and now,
right.
It's just... yeah, what I'm asking myself is, who's reading all these books? Because obviously the demand is going up, because if it wasn't, the companies would be going out of business, not growing like they're growing. So
yeah, that's a good indicator of the growth of that of the field.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. I go down to the Mart here in Atlanta, the merchandise and the gift mart, which is where wholesalers go to buy their goods, and you can really follow the economy, what the economy is doing by how busy they are at these marts, In the past, very few people were there. And that translates into how long you wait for the elevator, because there's 17 stories in the gift mart. So if you have to wait for the elevator a long time, the next 4 or 5 months are going to be very good economically for the country. It's very interesting.
That's funny. That is a good indicator.
it actually is. I mean, I've gone down there in the past where there was like hardly anybody there, and I was really worried about, because I'm a plastic surgeon, so obviously the state of the economy is important for at least part of the work we do, which is disposable income related. So,
right.
So it got to be, oh my goodness, we're in for it now, But
so are things picking up now?
I think it's in a slump. I think. After 2008, of course, it was in a slump. Then it picked up again slowly. But I think we're in another slump. I think we're in another, and I think it's because people are unsure with the election and with 2012. My feeling is people are putting things on hold,
I think that's right, yeah.
Do you get that impression, too? That it's just that they decide not to spend money right now because they're just uncertain. They've heard a lot about 2012, the end of it. They've heard a lot about, things that maybe Planet X causing pole shifts or other potential earthquakes, tsunamis, and volcanoes, which are really very intense right now if you actually look at the website showing them. Especially the earthquakes, so I think that's what people are worried about. They're just uncertain about the future, and they should be. I mean, this is a time when three cycles are coming to an end. The large cycle, the 360,000 year cycle, the in and out breath of Brahma is coming to the end at the end of this year. The 29,000 cycle with speciation and probably this galactic, energy wave we're in is, and the sun misbehaving and doing things is coming to an end, and then the 360 year cycle of Nibiru or Planet X making its orbit is also coming to an end at the end of this year. So I would say 2012 is a very unique year, and we're beginning to feel the uncertainty in things like world economy and so I don't know. I think that's probably, And not everybody's aware of those, of course. I mean, what I just told you, a lot of people aren't aware of it all. Of course, we do radio shows on them, so I'm real aware of them. I've done, you know, talked to all the experts in the world on that. But you know, the average person probably has very little awareness other than the fact that they're vaguely aware there might be more earthquakes and you know, more danger from natural phenomena right now without knowing exactly why.
Well, I put myself in the average person category for those topics.
Yeah, well, there's very interesting things happening right now, and energetically interesting. And if you meditate, you might become aware of certain spinning sensations in your body, in the areas of your chakras, and more just more different experiential things that are more intense now. And so we'll see what happens, you know. I don't know.
Mm.
It's different for everybody because, you know, we're all unique, but it certainly is something that it would be interesting to see what some of the people in the book say about that too, because they obviously are very in touch with their spiritual nature.
I don't know if there's anything along those lines in that book.
No, not in the book.
So.
But the book was written a while ago, wasn't it? I mean, the actual.
Yeah,
what
I'm
talking about didn't
chapter.
Really start happening until July. So, you know, there wouldn't be anything in the book for their own experiences because it hadn't happened yet.
No, they would have their own entheogenic experiences, but not anything.
Right, but not the other. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what the book was on, though, was their own experiences from drugs. That was the topic of the book. But in any case, it's pretty interesting to consider that this option is open to people, and that's why I wanted to have you on the show and to talk about what really is available to people who wish to have a spiritual experience. You know, not that.
Yeah.
It's the only way, but it's one way that that you can do, but probably need to leave the country to do it.
Yeah, my next book, which is coming out January 7th, I pick up on some of the ideas and elaborate. Like there's a whole chapter on how values switch during mystical experiences. Then there's a chapter on the new religious era, experiential area. There's a guest chapter by Charlie Grobe, who has used psychedelics to reduce death anxiety in terminal patients.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good use for them, I think.
I think that and post-traumatic stress disorder, I think, would be the first two areas that really catch on.
Yeah, I agree. I think that those are, we really realize that, you know, everybody is going to have, a time on their deathbed unless they have an accident and die quickly.
Right.
And the post-traumatic stress problem has really, really increased since the wars that we've been in.
There's a study going on now with returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan using MDMA or ecstasy as a post-traumatic stress treatment for those who have been recalcitrant to other treatments. And that's coming along very well from what I hear.
Well, that's good. That's good. I mean, certainly, I've had quite a bit of experience with post-traumatic stress disorder in my patients because I at one time was treating patients from 6 emergency rooms, including bad burns, bad car accidents, and victims of, you know, violent crime. So, it's very interesting. Plus, a lot of people, I was in the military, I was in the Air Force for 13 years, so obviously I had a lot of the veteran post-traumatic stress disorder. And this is something we really need to focus on, because these people can't have lives that are meaningful with this disease. I mean, and if they just drug them, I mean, that works to suppress the symptoms, but the disease is still there.
Right, and it's just not them, but all their family members are affected by it, too. So it's a multiple of 4 or 5 at least.
And something I didn't realize, and I don't know whether you know about it either, but you know the term going postal?
Yeah, I know the term, right.
Did you realize that a lot of the people that went postal were Vietnam vets coming back that were given jobs in the post office but not really treated for their post-traumatic stress disorder?
Oh, I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, didn't you always wonder why the post office was plagued with these problems?
Right. It's not a very sort of traumatic place to be.
Not really. I mean, you know, yeah. But they, you know, the government gave them jobs when they couldn't get jobs. And then our treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder was really bad. I did interview the author of War in the Soul, which is an excellent book if you've never read it.
No, I don't know about it.
Yeah, I can't remember the author's name, but the book is War in the Soul, and it's about the spiritual aspects of taking our young people and especially forcing them to go to war like we did in Vietnam. Different than when they volunteer, very different. And what it does to their soul, what it does to their, you know, when you force people to kill when they're really not killers, what that does. Just a fascinating book.
What's the name
of it? War in the Soul. But it's and what he did, he sponsored groups that went back to Vietnam and did, you know, social work, relief work with the people that they had previously, you know, been killing or disrupting their villages.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a type of penance. You can see how that would work. It's kind of a putting energy into something and then neutralizing that previous energy.
Yeah, working through it, yeah.
Working through it, right. But, you know, obviously that's another area where these drugs might be useful.
Because yeah, very definitely.
It's definitely a spiritual problem. I mean, that's a spiritual problem when you have to kill people or participate in disrupting their lives in a way that is against your religious beliefs. And that's why I fundamentally don't believe in the draft. I think that we can get more than enough people in the military just voluntarily, you know, with the educational benefits and the, you know, all the other things that they're doing to make it more attractive. Without, you know, there's plenty of people that don't mind killing people. We have those people in our society. We just have to channel them correctly. That's my opinion after being in the military anyways and seeing the bad effects of things, the post-traumatic stress problems that resulted from when people had to kill people. It's different when you get post-traumatic stress disorder when you were blown up, you know, when you and many of your friends died when your Humvee was blown up. You know, that's different. That's a different category.
Apparently, that's where a lot of stress from Afghanistan is coming.
Right.
From roadside bombs and so forth.
Right, because they drive on to an area where then there's a bomb that goes off. That's a very common way, and we're still seeing many of the veterans with physical wounds from that. So. Well, we're coming up to the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
I have a website. You can get it. www.academia.edu/Thomas Roberts. And a lot of my book reviews and articles and PowerPoints are on there. And if you can't find it that way, just search Thomas Roberts Psychedelics. It'll come up.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Roberts. It's been a great discussion, and I highly recommend your book for people who are interested in the subject. It's probably the best book I've read so far with the widest you know, ideas and documentation of the previous serious research into this area.
Well, thank you. As you can imagine, I had fun putting it together.
I bet you did. And you know, if you're interested, you can send me your other book when it comes out, and we can set up an interview for that as well.
Sure, I'll make sure that in her petitions I'll put you on the mailing list.
Super, super. Well, thank you very much. Next week we are interviewing Cindy Bentley, Celestial Being, How to Shift to Fifth Dimensional Living. And then on the 3rd of November, The Unfoldment, The Organic Path to Clarity, Power and Transformation. And then the next week, Frank Joseph on The Lost Worlds of Ancient America, Compelling Evidence of Ancient Immigrants, Lost Technologies, and Places of Power. So, and we do also have next week a Millennium Healthcare event where Dr. Brad Gould will be talking about your vitamins and supplements, how you can evaluate which are good. That's next Tuesday at the Dunwoody, at the Dunwoody office. Again, thanks so much, Dr. Roberts. I appreciate you taking the time. And if everybody will join us next week, we will be having Cindy Bentley. Thank you very much.